Neve Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly team at Neve's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit nevesolicitors.co.uk. Neve Solicitors, your complete legal solution.
And welcome to The Parent Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM, your place, your voice, your music. We're very pleased to have you all listening tonight. The show is an interesting one, as always. We're going to be talking about children's friendships. As always, we've got wonderful guests. We've got Professor of Education and Equality at University of London, Rosalind George, and Ulla Patney, who's an educational psychologist right here in St Albans, which is very exciting. So what we're going to be talking about tonight are children's friendships in general, but Ross's actual research was on girls' friendship networks, which is a very specific research interest. And I suppose in particular, we're very interested in, as parents, how we can help our children make friends, what happens when it goes wrong at school, and hopefully, you know, find a way of helping our children through any particular difficulties they have. So without further ado, we're going to speak to Ross George on the phone now. Let's hope she's there. Are you there, Ross?
I am.
Ross, tell us a little bit about your research into girls' friendship networks at school.
Okay. Well, I think kind of all research starts from kind of a nagging feeling, something you feel is not right. And what happened with my research was, when I was at school, primary school, I found myself on certain times, certain days, being excluded from my group of friends. I didn't know what it was. I was fairly bewildered by this. And then I'd go into school another day and I'd be included again. Didn't know why, but somebody else was excluded. Kind of put that sort of worry to the back of my mind. And then two things happened. I started reading Margaret Atwood's Cat's Eye, which is a brilliant novel about young girls' relationships. And also had my own daughter and my friends' daughters. And I came to realize that this was a kind of common thing that was happening, that quite often, you know, there were groups of girls and particular girls would be excluded or included. And for no apparent reason.
And Ross, this is very, very common, because even from just flagging up that we were doing this show tonight, we've had so many people write in and talk about their own experiences. I went to an all-girls school. I can completely identify with what you're saying as well. So tell us about what you learned from sort of hanging out, if you were, with the children themselves. What did that teach you about the way in which they make friends, in particular with girls?
The interesting thing is that obviously this doesn't happen with all girls, you know. But it is a common enough feature for, as you say, to show that there is a troubling aspect from their friendship. I mean, friendships, you actually, you know, one generally thinks friendships are chosen. You choose your friends freely, but quite often they're not. They're contingent on things maybe like the parents' friends, or the particular schools they go to, or other social arenas. And so the friendship becomes contingent on other things.
And in a way, I think parents have, or feel at least with young children, that they have a lot of control over friendships, or at least they try to have.
Yeah.
So you're dead right. You know, it's very convenient if your friends' children get on with your children.
Yeah.
And you sort of foster particular friendships, perhaps.
Yes, that's right. And it's quite interesting. I followed groups of girls right from, you know, primary school through into secondary school. And when they got to secondary school, a couple of girls said, well, really, she wasn't really a great friend of mine, but she was, my mum and her mum were friends, so we kind of got pushed together. And it wouldn't have been someone I would have chosen, necessarily. So I think that happens quite a bit.
And isn't that, I suppose, we'll have to ask Ulla later on, but isn't that a healthy sign that children actually say, do you know what, I actually remember when my young son, who was 7, said, do you know what, I don't think I really want to go to that party, we're not actually friends. They start telling you that they've got feelings of their own about their own friendships.
Yeah, yes, I mean, it's excellent, if, you know, that they can recognise You know, maybe they don't want to be with someone, or maybe they do. But I think quite often what my research found was in the kind of, certainly at primary schools, in the classroom where you're kind of stuck together for most of the day. You know, in that classroom, you might break off for literacy or numeracy and go with other groups. But generally, most of your kind of existence is within that classroom. That you do get caught up with these kind of friendship networks where this kind of hierarchy can exist. And it happens to quite young girls as well, you know, as young as year two, I found in my research.
And tell us, I mean, I think I know which hierarchy you're referring to, the sort of the queen bees.
I don't actually like the term queen bees because I think I have a deep affection for girls, and I wouldn't ever want my kind of research to be criticised for just putting girls down. I think what happens, certainly within Western cultures, is that there's a kind of Western construction of femininity, of how girls should be, how women should be. And it's about being kind, about putting people, you know, before yourself, being selfless in many, many ways, because that's what's valued in young girls. And we learn that very, very quickly. But on the other hand, within this current culture of attainment and targets and kind of top girls, where they've got to achieve well, it actually sets up a dilemma, because in order to do that, you've got to be very individual, very autonomous. And so you've got the kind of the niceness on one hand, and then the trying to be yourself on the other hand. And those two kind of positions are very, very difficult to manage for many girls.
And the converse might be that boys may be encouraged to be competitive.
Absolutely, yes.
And it's sort of that culture, that educational culture, suits what we're sort of perhaps labelling them as parents. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think boys are given permission, aren't they, to be competitive. They're given permission to play on the football field, and, you know, that they're, you know, if they fight, they're not kind of reprimanded for it too much. Maybe a bit if it's over the top. But, you know, boys play fighting. Girls don't get that same kind of, those kind of sort of freedoms. So, in a way, they have to kind of push away, divert that kind of competitiveness onto somebody else. So, for example, to maintain the fact that they still look kind and thoughtful and caring, they have to take away any contamination that they may not be. And that's why I think possibly they may talk about others and put others down to adults, because they very much want to remain as if they are kind of perfect in a way. And that's kind of a thing they learn at a very early age. Does that make sense?
Yes, definitely. And I think you're making me understand more about the parents' role, like how guilty we might be as parents in terms of setting up particular labels, encouraging stereotypical attitudes. Whereas I think with boys, would it be a generalisation to say that perhaps parents are a bit more lackadaisical about who they're friends with or not friends with? They're not sort of constantly being really thinking very, very hard about, you know, who they're playing with and if they're being nice to each other. I don't know if it comes into that dialogue with them.
I don't know. To be perfectly honest, I didn't sort of... I followed girls through, because what I also found when I started out on this research, there's huge amounts of sociology in terms of schooling and education, and a lot of it was kind of the looking at much more at boys, and then the findings were generalised across to girls. I wanted to look at girls because it became part of the kind of movement for girls' studies. And there wasn't anything about girls' friendships at this age.
Now, what did you find in your research, if anything, about popularity? What makes a child popular in primary school, for example?
Well, I that's another really interesting... Can I just get back to the thing on parents? Because yeah. I would not actually blame parents at all. I think parents are very much aware of what happens with their children, and really want to do the right things. I think it's the messages from society that tell girls and boys what's appropriate. appropriate and what isn't. I don't think it's parents as such. I mean, we're all subject and shaped by what we hear in the media and what we read and the conversations we have. So,
and every parent wants their child to be not only happy at school and treating other people well, but they want to know that their child is, you know, treating other children well and being treated well. So I think it goes both ways.
And I think we all know that children achieve if, you know, if they're healthy and they're happy, you know, and their experience of school is like that. So
now, on the topic of well-being, your research did flag up, I think, the fact that it can be much more emotionally damaging than people assume. To young girls, is that correct? That's the sort of the low level, if you like, exclusionary practices in the classroom. So you might walk in the morning and your friends decide they're not going to sit beside you, or they don't invite you to sit for lunch at the table with them, that type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very damaging. Very damaging indeed, because they don't know why. They don't know what's causing this. And they just have to sit and bide their time until they're included once more. And I think another really interesting aspect is the fact that why do girls hang on to destructive friendships, you know, when they can free themselves from them? And
but do you think that's a matter of social confidence, that they say, that person is not treating me nicely, I do not want to be their friend, or why do they persevere?
I think they persevere because the way they perceive the alternative is having no one to sit with, no one to walk home with, no one to play with. You know, why they don't go to another group of girls where that may not be the case, where the friendship may not be as destructive, was something that I couldn't actually get to the bottom with. They seem to want to cling on to a group where the relationship was potentially damaging at times.
There was a lovely piece that I heard today on the BBC News about your research, and it interviewed young girls actually who were at that sort of primary school age, and a lot of them talked about being in this kind of threesome in friendship groups that doesn't seem to work terribly well, that always there's one left out. It's evolving constantly. Can you tell us a little bit more about that sort of structure of friendship?
My research actually found the groups were bigger than that,
right.
And there was a kind of like a kind of, if you imagine concentric circles, and in the middle is the kind of the leader, and then in the outer circle you might get two or three other girls, and then there's an outer circle which is a peripheral group of girls. And what the research found was that the leader stayed very firmly in her position in the middle of the group, and then the ones in the kind of the outer group changed places with the ones in the peripheral group depending on what was going on and what was happening. And the leader could kind of control and manage this group by saying, for example, if one of the girls in the inner circle was getting close to her, or maybe put a challenge to her, she would then befriend somebody in the peripheral group and bring them home for tea and things like that, and reposition that girl in the group.
So the patterns are constantly shifting, friendships are shifting within that larger group.
Yeah, yeah.
What do we know about the leader?
The leader of the group was generally the most socially skilled, a very socially skilled, isn't it? Very articulate, and as able, if not more able, than the other children in the class, generally, not just in the friendship group, but in the class.
So academic attainment was a sort of a feature of that role, was it?
Yeah, yeah. And that was the case right across, I found. And in terms of, and also the leader was not necessarily the most popular, because other girls were popular, but they weren't necessarily the leaders. So
That's interesting.
You cannot conflate leadership and popularity. They are I found them to be two different things.
Now, interestingly, if that child, the leader, is doing academically very, very well, the teacher presumably has a very positive response to them.
Yes,
which
absolutely
might reinforce that position. Is that correct?
It does, yes. It absolutely does, yes. Because what happens, a lot of this kind of inclusion-exclusionary practices goes on beneath the radar. It goes on beneath the sight line of the teacher or other adults in the classroom. And, you know, so the kind of the whispering, the exclusion, the exclusion, it's not seen, it's not visible. And the girls actually, even within the group, kind of perform friendship. They look like they're sort of, they give each other hugs in the morning and, you know, they appear, to all intents and purposes, to be a very cohesive group. But in fact, you know, there may be one girl in that group at that time who's feeling very excluded. And so teachers, they don't always see what's happening. I mean, I used to be a teacher myself, and I didn't give enough attention to this kind of behaviour that was going on in the classroom, despite the fact that I'd actually experienced it myself. So I think it's very hard, and I also think it's harder still these days in this kind of climate of attainment and targets and regulation.
Because teachers have got so much else to worry about.
Exactly.
As well,
you know, they haven't, you know, one teacher said to me when I asked them about it, said, oh, girls falling out and bullying each other. Sorry, I haven't got time for that.
Yeah, so it's kind of belittling the problem in a way, because you're talking about these children, their well-being, you know, and if they're miserable and unhappy.
Yeah, yes. And also there's a belief that this is just part of how girls are. You know, it's part of growing up. They get over it. They get through it. You know, it's not really a problem. It's not really an issue. But, I mean, the responses to the research suggest to me it is such an issue.
For the girls, just out of curiosity, in the peripheral group, would you argue their well-being is quite dependent on perhaps the children who sort of select them to come into the inner circle occasionally?
The ones on the peripheral seemed to had kind of roles within the group. So, for example, one of the girls on the periphery would be positioned as a listener to the leader, right? And the leader would share her confidences with her. But she would never be allowed to come into the inner circle because she had these confidences and she could potentially talk about the leader.
Undermine her.
But the other thing is, another view of it is that she liked this role of listener because it kept her in the group. You know, there was
so you sort of hang on to the job you've been given, if you like.
Yeah. So the girls had different roles within the group. You know, some were for going out with, some were for listening, some were for, you know, playing with or, you know, discussing different things with. They all seemed to have a kind of a sort of role within the group, which is quite interesting.
Now, in terms of teacher awareness, I mean, if a teacher is completely aware of what's going on in that classroom, how can they possibly intervene?
I think, first of all, if a girl comes up and says to the teacher, or any child, obviously, you know, this is going on, they have to be believed. They have to have time spent on it and not be dismissed in the way I've just sort of described some of the teachers saying it. Not all teachers are like that, obviously, but if the girl comes forward, because it's quite a big thing to come forward and actually say this is going on, if they're dismissed or not believed, they're not going to do it again, and it'll just carry on. The other thing is, I think we have to get away from the fact this is an individual girl's problem. It's a cultural problem. It's a problem of the culture of the friendship groups. And that needs to be tackled kind of head on, I think, in kind of different aspects of, you know, classroom pedagogy and curriculum, that space needs to be found to talk about this so that girls can feel a lot stronger. And it's not just about them as individuals.
I mean, really, the word that you're referring to is resilience. I suppose that our children have to be resilient in their friendships and able to navigate them without it sort of being so damaging.
Yes, it's so hard, though. It is so hard, but you need to have your parents on your side, teachers on the side,
yeah.
and the school on and the schools on the side, and you know, to take it to a school and for the school not to go beyond the classroom, but you know, for the kind of the management structure of the school to actually see this is an issue. Is critical, because if you actually get a whole school response, then that will help enormously in challenging these kind of insidious kind of culture that's happening with these girls.
Now, a couple of last things. When you mentioned the word damaging, in what way is it damaging? In terms of, did you look at long-term impact or just the immediate sort of, you know, fear of going to school or anxiety about, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's many ways it's damaging. I've had emails from, several emails from parents saying, the children won't go to school. I had a child who was in year six who didn't go to school for two terms because of what was going on. So that's the immediate impact. My research is written up and it's into a book, but it's called Girls in a Goldfish Bowl. And the goldfish bowl was a direct quote from one of the girls who said to me, when I'm feeling excluded, I go into the classroom and I feel everyone's looking at me like I'm in a goldfish bowl, you know, felt that kind of penetration.
Lovely. So you wrote the book around that quote, and it's Girls in a Goldfish Bowl, which is basically the summary of your research into that area.
Yes. But the long-term effects, I think when they move from primary to secondary school, in secondary school, some of the girls who'd struggled at primary school with friendships, they looked around the classroom and saw who were that, like the cool group or the noisy group, and said, "I'm not going to move into that friendship group because I know what's going to happen." And they made decision to go with a much quieter group who didn't seem to need to have that kind of attention. So they managed, and I mean, I've spoken to many of the girls that I researched who are now in the sixth forms and older, and they talk about how being part of this research project has actually enabled them to think about how their relationships with other girls worked as they got older.
But it's quite interesting, isn't it, that they have developed a strategy by the time they get to secondary school, or how they're going to approach friendships. I mean, does that? I would love to know if that actually happens with boys.
Well, yes.
I mean, it's fascinating. We'll have to ask Ula in a minute. She's here in the studio as well, burning to respond to everything. But just on a last point, I mean, you did that research a couple of years ago, wasn't it, Ross?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
You got an amazing response to it, didn't you?
Oh, phenomenal. And
so it really hit a nerve.
It does. And I mean, people email me, ring me. And, you know, I've been asked to go and talk about it in schools because it's so many people's experiences. And as I said, this is not, you know, as I said, I hold girls in deep affection, and I want, you know, research to have a kind of positive impact, and for girls for this to be actually tackled so that generations of girls don't have to actually put up with this for any longer.
Yeah, it made me think about this week. I came across the organisation Ban Bossy. Have you heard of it? It's in the States. It's a States-based organisation, www.banbossy.com.
And
it's all about stop calling our girls bossy. It's when actually they've got leadership skills.
Yes, so yes. It's
just the terminology and the language that we use to describe particular gender is actually very damaging as a culture, isn't it?
And that's what results in stereotypes and, you know, that kind of, this is how girls are, and this is, you know, what else can you expect? And it's, you know, it's just them being them. And in fact, it's a much more deeper and much more complex issue than I think until recently, has been given much attention. It's just been kind of let go.
Well, thank you for bringing it to our attention. It's wonderful because it's raising such a debate in our heads and getting us to think about, you know, how perhaps we as individuals contribute to, you know, to those stereotypes and as a culture, how we can go about turning things around. So thank you so much, Professor Ross George.
Oh, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Lovely. All the very best, Nolly.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Radio Verla. And welcome back to the Parents Show on Radio Verla 92.6 FM. Now, we're talking about children's friendships tonight. We've been talking to Professor Ross George about her research into girls' friendship networks. But now, thankfully, we've got Ulla Patney, an educational psychologist here in the studio, to help us, well, to make sense of what we've heard, Ulla. So welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much. Yes, I can clearly understand why it would make very uncomfortable news to parents and teachers what Professor Ross has just said in terms of friendship groups. And I think many parents wouldn't necessarily know if their girls are within a friendship group that's not working as you might want it to, and that their daughters might be the ones who are perhaps not part of the group at that moment. But we do unfortunately hear about it more often than not, that girls go in and out of friendship groups. And it's not until this research has been carried out that there are some conclusive evidence that it has perhaps a long-term effect on young people, because up till now it's been quite inconclusive about the long-term effects of going in and out of friendships.
Now, you've obviously got such experience in lots of different schools with boys and girls. I'm sure a lot of parents are listening to that wondering, gosh, it does really matter whether you send your child, does it, to a co-ed school or a single-sex school? Like, what can you do to actually avoid friendships that work in that way?
I think it's not so much about whether it's a co-ed school or single-sex school. It's about the ethos of the school and an ethos of friendships and collaboration can be in either school, really. And I think many single-sex schools are very good at fostering a caring environment. I don't think we can talk about the split. I mean, there is some evidence to suggest that girls might be more verbal than boys and want to more, they talk more, and they might be more nasty to each other than boys are. But I wonder sometimes if that's because the research has focused more on girls than on boys, whom we know at the moment tend to get on with playing football or rugby or whatever they might play. They tend to be more task-oriented, whereas girls can sit and talk for hours.
So school culture really matters, and I suppose that's where responsibility comes, I suppose, and teacher awareness might have an input.
Oh, totally, yes. And I think that it's news to teachers that they play a role in how girls are to each other and how they don't catch these groups, because I think teachers generally would not want to do anything that could be detrimental to a child, because everyone knows that a child who feels good about school, who feels at ease at school, feels welcome, feel they belong, would achieve better academically. And like Dr. Ross was saying, Professor Ross, sorry, that is what school is very much about.
Now, let's get to the practicalities of this. You're in the kitchen making the dinner, or you come home from work, whatever it might be, and you're in the car and you're picking up your child from school, and they say, "Mummy, nobody wants to sit beside me at lunch," or somebody said a nasty thing about me, or what would you advise parents to do when they hear about that kind of dynamic in their child's friendship?
I would ask my child about whether it was just today, or has it been going on for some time? And was there a particular child who didn't want to sit with them, that their child really wanted to sit next to? Is it all children who don't want to sit next to them?
Is it often the case with especially primary school children, they might tell mum or dad after quite a long time of putting up with that exclusionary behaviour or negative behaviour? Or is it the case they often tell mum or dad when it immediately happens?
I think that depends very much on the child, and it depends very much on the relationship between the child and the parent. So some parents would talk to their children every day in some depth about their school day, and they would probably hear about an incident like this earlier than a child who doesn't talk so much to their child.
Right.
Having said that, again, it depends on the quality of their relationship. Yes.
And it's very difficult for any parent, I think, to get the information out of their child when they, you know, when they're trying to ascertain how the school day was. But picking up from that, you would find out whether it's been a one-off incident or whether it's been, and if it's one child or several children, and for how long.
Yes.
Right. Do you intervene and speak to the teacher, or do you ring the other child's parents? How would you advise parents to proceed?
That depends very much on the situation, I would say, because if, like Professor Ross was talking about, if the other children are children of the parents' friends, then you might talk to the parents about it because you know them well. But if you don't know the parents, that could feel quite difficult for some parents to talk to them about. So I would go to the teacher and also just check out how they think the situation is, and have a chat again with their child about what's going on, perhaps.
Now, you and I discussed this earlier. Mm. It's very difficult as a parent to approach a school. You know, you feel it can be quite intimidating. You're sometimes in awe of teachers, afraid of teachers. You don't want to annoy them. You don't want to bother them. Tell us how to speak to teachers about a problem, because we never want to come across as neurotic or pushy or, you know,
indifferent.
So it's very difficult balance. What is your general advice on that?
I think for parents to start from the premises that you want the best for your child, and the teacher also wants the best for your child. So
you share that goal.
Yes,
very explicitly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think come in with that question in mind. Come in and feel like you want to check out and work with them. Sometimes we hear about parents who come in and they're not very sure. They don't really know why they're there. And so not much comes of the inquiry, basically. But other parents know exactly why they're there, and sometimes that can feel a little bit accusatory towards teachers.
So perhaps they feel they have to be, you know, I don't know, quite aggressive in a way to get their point across, when actually what you're suggesting is, you say, how can we work together on this? I've become aware of it.
Yes. Or, yes, so the parent might think they are aware of something, but when they check out with the teachers what's going on, it might be their child's perception that something is going on, and the teacher has a different perception. And I think then it's up to the parent a little bit and the teacher to work together to see how they can square those two perceptions, because perhaps the teacher has a little bit of work to do in order to find out what's really going on, and perhaps also the parent has some work to do to ask their child about what's really going on, and hopefully they'll meet in the middle to see what's going on so that they can do something about it.
Now, seeing an educational psychologist sounds drastic. Should it be a first step for parents? Is it normally? Or, you know, are educational psychologists easily accessible through the school? Is it on the advice of the teacher that a child would see one? Like, what is the role of the educational psychologist, and how would parents come across them?
We would come into the picture once the school and the parents have tried to work out the situation and try to find ways forward. And we wouldn't really get involved until there was a real ingrained problem. Well, it doesn't have to be ingrained, but until the school or the parents don't know how to move on.
Right.
But it would really be in the court of the school to let us know we need to get involved. We do have some what we call community consultations for parents and teachers, and any parent is welcome. They can book onto these slots. They're out there in the community. They run in all areas in Hertfordshire. And parents are very welcome to come and talk to us about any issue they might have. They're not many of them, and they're very popular, but they're there.
And where are they? I can hear everyone saying, where are they? When is it?
They're signposted in. We put out flyers to each school in the area, and I think they are in doctor surgeries as well, and they are in children's centres, our little flyers, so it should be possible to know exactly where we have these.
So say if you walk into the children's centre, you could say, have you got the name of the team, the educational psychology team?
Yes, and a number we can call.
Lovely. Okay, yes, that's very helpful.
Absolutely.
Ula, how much would you advocate parents embracing relationships with for your children, like encouraging them, encouraging play dates to kind of, if your child feels like he's playing alone, to kind of nurture them? Or is that too interfering?
No, absolutely not. I think it depends on the age of the child, how much and what you would do with them. But absolutely, I think that these friendship groups are so important, and there's so much evidence to show that they're beneficial for children in so many ways. Not only do they practice what they learn, they practice their social skills when they're with others, and they practice also what they learn during the curriculum. They practice, it has so many benefits, friendships, that I would definitely get involved. And when the children are small, I would do play dates and perhaps help them along, you know, have little tasks for them to do, or things, activities for them to do, whether that's building Lego or baking cakes or whatever. And later on, I would sort of taper it off a little bit, but I would still have a chat with my teenagers about it if they are finding it a little bit hard. Suggest movies to them they might go and see and discuss afterwards. Provide opportunities for them to discuss what they have seen, or books that they have read, or maybe just going swimming, kick a ball around, or have a picnic in the park. It doesn't have to be particularly complex, but I do think it's really important that these friendships are encouraged. And I think where parents, sorry, I could talk about this forever. I think where parents find it hard, they should not hesitate to go and get help from teachers, just to get a little way in to see, who does my child speak to while in school? How can I help it along? And how can you help it along? And how can we nourish these relationships?
I think it's interesting on school reports that they'll flag up who your child speaks to. That's always quite interesting, because it may be children that you've no idea, never heard of. Or,
yes.
But so you're suggesting it's a good thing to focus on when you get, say, the school reporter you hear. Just ask, are they enjoying friendships with children?
Where the synergies are. Is that what you're saying,
yes.
Nuala?
Who's
where you see their,
to them?
Which is, I'm so glad to hear you say that. And I'm sure that'll empower a lot of parents out there, because you kind of think, You desperately want your child to be happy. You want them to have friends that they feel themselves with. And if it's okay to kind of nudge them along that way, then all the better. There's always an awareness that you're being a bit too kind of interfering as a parent as well, you know. But you're saying certainly in primary, it's okay to nudge these along, suggest activities.
Yes. I think it is, but at the same time, taking into account your child, because some children are very sociable and it'll be very easy for them, and other children are not very sociable and they prefer to not be with others, and they need more time on their own than other children. And I think it's about that respectful relationship and knowing your child and knowing when they've had enough, really, and when they would really like to have more friendships, and maybe also knowing about them needing to have some skills, to learn some skills to build friendships and to also maintain friendships. And I think as a parent, you need to be very alert to that and very in tune with your child, because it's so easy to just think that because it has so many benefits, every child must have 100 friends. It's not true. Some children are very happy just having the one, and some children are very happy to not have friends for a long time and just do things on their own.
And so the way of measuring your child's happiness is and well-being is about how they say, if they're happy having one friend or...
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
It's not about our judgment about what's a good position to have socially. It's what they say.
And who says that it's better to have 20 friends than having one or two very well selected friends? Yeah, I would question that. And I think that you're absolutely right. Go with your child and go with your intuition here. Don't go with the friends, your friends, and measure your child by how many friends your friends' children have, because it might not be right for your
child.
It's
a poor indicator.
Yes.
And Ulla, we were speaking about when there's problem relationships, if your children are having problems, how much would you advocate bringing problem relationships into your house to see if, you know, if you can, outside the environment of school, that things makes it better? For example, if there's a child that your child is always fighting with, invite them home for tea to see if that can kind of smooth things out. Would you be in favour of that, or let it just pan out or play itself out in school?
I think that's a very difficult one to answer, because I would question, why would you want your child to be with somebody they are always arguing with? So I would try to avoid that relationship and instead build on what's good. What would be the purpose of trying to mend something that perhaps cannot be mended?
Fantastic. That's great. Great. Thank you very much.
Also, Ulla, we've just had a message in about if children are choosing friends that the parent really doesn't think are good for them at all. But it's not that they're inviting them home for play dates, but is it right? Is it to shape the direction of what way the friendship's going, say, in the early stages of secondary school, if you feel like the child is a poor influence on your own child?
Yes, I would question that. What does that poor influence look like? Why is that a poor influence? What is it that makes
the parent uncomfortable?
Yes, what is it exactly? And as a parent, I would bite my tongue, and instead I would ask my child, what do you get out of this relationship? What is it you find attractive about it? Try and find out, what is it that entices you into this group of friends?
And try and acknowledge it. So she must be very exciting, or he must be very exciting, because you're just trying to listen to what's appealing about that particular person.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. And you want to find out about your child, what makes them tick, basically, in this friendship. What is it they're looking for? What is it that friendship makes them feel like? And I think inevitably, also I would talk to my child about what... So in friendship groups, as Professor Ross was saying, there are different roles. And I think it's fair to say that any child would play a particular role in a friendship group. And the parent could ask their own child, what role do you think you're playing in this? Mm. Are you the listener? Are you the doer? Are you the creative person? Are you the...
That's a lovely question, isn't it? It's a great place to start the conversation, isn't it?
I think so. And it's sort of non-controversial, and it's...
just a discussion, a family discussion.
Absolutely. And it shows interest in your child. And perhaps, you never know, maybe that is the interest that your child is seeking, a place of belonging, or seeking to feel needed or wanted, or you just don't know what it might be that they're seeking in this friendship.
And school friendships, obviously, they're not in isolation. They're trying to survive within a culture. They're trying to negotiate their way.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's so many pressures.
And it's such a complex culture, starting in a new school or being part of a school, because as we heard Professor Ross say, sometimes you're in, sometimes you're out, and it's very uncomfortable to be out. And there would be some children who would want to be in a group, I mean, and they would do it at any price. And I think here it is up to the parents to try and find out what it is their children are seeking from this group, and see if they can perhaps have what they seek in the group somewhere else, or perhaps from a group outside school, or from some activity that they
do
in school.
That's a great idea. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I'd never even thought of that, because you just assume you've got to make that work. But absolutely, you know, their hobby could provide that kind of sense of bonding that they need.
But also, I think it might be the case that they want to be friends with someone because they're very funny, because they're trying to develop, they're attracted to that. They want to develop their own sense of being funny, you know, or they sort of adopt friends that fill that gap that they might experience in themselves. Would you think that's...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Definitely. Yes. And at the same time, it might be the leadership skills in somebody that they want to imitate or learn from. And It just might be their initiative, their courage. And I think, yeah, you could, any child could develop them in many different ways.
So that lovely question about what is it that you love about your friend?
Yes.
And just let them openly discuss whatever it is without judgment.
Yes, and also ask them. You see, there might be some relationships that truly are detrimental or not so good to be encouraging. And I would say that they're probably few, they're found few between, but they exist. And I think for the parents to then ask their child, how do you see yourself in a couple of years' time, maybe in 5 years' time, maybe when you grow up, and how does that fit in with the character that you're playing here? And mm-hmm. how are you going to develop into what you are going to be if you continue down this trajectory that you might be going down here? And many young people, many more than we think, are able to think that through and come to some really good conclusions themselves. So I think sometimes parents think they have to do too much for their children, where in fact they have to ask some questions that make their children think.
Brilliant. We're just shaking our heads in agreement. This is fab.
Absolutely. So useful, Ulla. Thanks very much for that. Thanks for joining us on the Parents Show this evening, and we'll be back next week with another great show lined up for you.
Neve Solicitors are proud to sponsor the Parents Show. The friendly team at Neve's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit nevesolicitors.co.uk. Neve Solicitors, your complete legal solution.